Okay, so we're going to begin with in Mark 8. Last week we saw Jesus focus on building faith in his disciples, and particularly those disciples that were going to lead the ministry. Jesus also encouraged faith. He encouraged great faith, and we saw that in a couple of instances. One of the things that we want to also look at, and we'll look at today, is Jesus is going to begin to shift the focus of his teachings as he prepares for his death and to be glorified, and we'll see that as well. Wait a minute. Let's see. We'll go back a minute. I'll just stay there for a second. Last week we talked about Jesus feeding the 5,000, and learned some lessons for that. I'm going to show a chart here in a minute that's going to show some differences between the two miracles, feeding the 5,000 and feeding the 4,000. But one of the things that you see is, again, Jesus is challenging his disciples to come to faith and to have faith in every situation. As we read in feeding the 5,000, one of the disciples said to Jesus when he says, well, hey, you feed these people, you give them something to eat. They said 8 months' wages won't feed this crowd. You know, kind of a half-empty, glass half-empty philosophy that Jesus was working on. And feeding the 4,000, the grand statement was, but where in this remote place can anyone get enough bread to feed them? So again, it's like, okay, Jesus fed 5,000 people. You witnessed that. But there's still like, okay, Jesus, how are we going to do this? So you see the lack of faith and you see what Jesus is dealing with here. So let's begin by looking at a comparison of the two miracles. There are several things that are in common and a few things that I noted there in the red that are a little bit different that I found interesting. Now, we're going to do a little bit of a word study here in Greek. Now, Douglas Jacoby, that some of you guys know, is a teacher in our kingdom and in the church. And Doug says that, you know, some of us need to get serious about learning the Greek and stop playing around with it. And out of respect to Doug, I'm not one of those people. So I'm thankful for the people who have researched this, but, you know, I don't know much about the Greek. But, you know, it's been interesting looking at some of these things and learning from it. So that's what we'll do in the next couple of slides. So we see here the things that the two miracles had in common. They take place in the wilderness. Jesus demonstrates his compassion. Jesus asks how many loaves you have. They all ate and were satisfied. A number of things that were different. The number of loaves picked up. The number of people fed. And the number of baskets left over. Okay, but let's look at these three things here. In feeding the 5,000, Jesus addresses an audience of Jews, whereas with the 4,000, there were Gentiles. In feeding the 5,000, I don't have the map again today, but he was in Bethsaida, which is on the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee, and a lot of fishing villages, a lot of Jews lived in that area, whereas he was in the Decapolis, which was mostly a Gentile area. Second thing, Jesus' prayer. Mark uses the Gentile Christian form of blessing in feeding the 4,000, but the Jewish form of blessing in feeding the 5,000. Let's look at it here. So Mark uses two different Greek words to refer to Jesus' prayer before meals. The first is eulogio, which you guys will in a minute think of what that's similar to, which literally means he blesses our good words. To speak good words to or about someone is to bless them. This is a typical Jewish blessing he refers to in feeding the 5,000. Anybody know where we have a word that's representative of this Greek word? Eulogy, you know, to speak good words about someone. The second word used to describe Jesus' prayer, feeding 4,000, is Eucharistio, to give thanks. It is interesting to note that the term Eucharist is used by some Christians in reference to Holy Communion or the Lord's Supper, which comes from that Greek word. So what's interesting here is that Jesus blessed the meal in the same way, but Mark, in addressing the Gentiles, now this is a Gentile crowd, but he's also writing the Gentiles, he used the form of blessing, the Greek word, that they are more familiar with. Thought that was pretty interesting. Okay, the third difference was the baskets that they picked up, the baskets of food. On the left refers to the 5,000 being fed, and the word is kophinos, which is a personal basket or a lunch basket. And you, of course, you see the difference in size. Whereas in feeding the 4,000, they picked up 7 hampers, spores, of food. So you see a big difference here of 12 baskets, personal size, that probably could fit into one hamper, 7 hampers of food. And I thought that was interesting because I think what it demonstrates is Jesus' ability to bless abundantly. And I think that must have been a faith bill. He had so much extra food. Maybe Jesus was planning, okay, they might want a snack on the way, you know, when they're leaving. But, you know, to me, I think it's quite a contrast that shows the abundance of what Jesus can do. And hopefully that was a faith builder to the disciples. All right, so next we're going to talk about the yeast of the Pharisees and of Herod. The Pharisees came and began to question Jesus. To test him, they asked him for a sign from heaven. He sighed deeply and said, "Why does this generation ask for a sign? Truly I tell you, no sign will be given it." Then he left them, got back into the boat, and crossed to the other side. The disciples had forgotten to bring bread, except for one loaf they had with them in the boat. "Be careful," Jesus warned them. "Watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod." They discussed this with one another and said, "Is it because we have no bread?" Aware of this discussion, Jesus asked them, "Why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see and ears but fail to hear? And don't you remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many basketful of pieces did you pick up?" So once again, Jesus challenges the disciples on their hard heart. You know, it's like, you didn't see what I did here? It's not about bread. It's about the yeast of the Pharisees. And he's talking about the leaven, their teachings, and how it would affect things. Now, interestingly enough, you don't see, Jesus said no sign will be given to them. Now, in Matthew's count and in Luke, they talk about the sign of Jonah. Jesus is writing to a Gentile group. Mark is writing to a Gentile group, and he does not include that. You know, the Bible says Jews demanded a sign, Paul says, and Greeks look for wisdom. So the Jews were always looking for signs. What Mark does not include that here. But he turns his attention to the threat of the religious leaders. So just a little teachings about yeast so we could better understand this. Anyone here ever bake any bread with yeast? Okay, Jessica, few people, okay. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't take much yeast and bread to make it rise, you know. Takes probably about a teaspoon to bake an average size loaf of bread. And so the point Jesus is trying to make is just like yeast causes bread to rise, yeast spreads and works through people's lives. And if it's in a good way, good will come out of it. But in a negative way, negative things will come out of it. Now, here in the slide, the Jews did not allow yeast in their offerings. And this is symbolic of when the Jews came out of Egypt under Moses' leadership. You know, you guys remember the Passover and they put blood over the doorposts. Well, they baked bread that did not have leaven in it, because it says they left in haste. They had to leave in a hurry, and so to bake bread with leaven or yeast in it would take time. So it's symbolic of the fact that God hurriedly got the people out of Egypt so he could destroy the Egyptians. And so that's the goal there. But everywhere, with the exception of Matthew 13, yeast is referred to in the Bible is for something evil. It says it works through the whole batch of dough. And there in Galatians 5, it's a discussion about circumcision that was being placed on the people as a prerequisite. Unjudged sin in the church, 1 Corinthians 5. You know, if someone, the leadership does not deal with sin, that will spread and impact the church. So what was Jesus referring to here? In Luke 12:1, it says, "Meanwhile, when a crowd of many thousands had gathered, so that they were trampling on one another, Jesus began to speak first to his disciples, 'Be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy.'" And you see that real clearly in Matthew 23. Jesus was warning his disciples is that you've got to watch out for hypocrisy and what these guys are trying to do to my teachings. You know, I did a quick search in the Bible, in the Gospels, and looked at several different things that the Pharisees and the teachers of the law challenged Jesus on. They challenged him on healing the paralytic, eating with sinners, fasting, the Sabbath. Jesus was called a prince of demons. They challenged him on hand washing, that tradition we talked about last week, divorce, not paying taxes to Caesar, the greatest commandment, the woman in adultery, and more than anything, they challenged his authority, which is what they were doing here. So Jesus said, beware of the yeast of the hypocrisy of people who are trying to destroy God's work. And this was meant for the people in general, but it was mostly meant for his disciples, those men he had chosen. As guys, you're going to have to take a stand on this. You know, I don't know where we are in this crowd as far as how old you are spiritually, but if you're probably a year or two old spiritually, probably all you think about, for the most part, is reading your Bible, praying, and sharing your faith. And that's kind of how it is when you're a young disciple. But as time goes by, you see more and more that you've got to take a stand for the gospel. And you're going to be challenged with that. Of course, you're challenged from day one, but it becomes more and more aware that you got to take a stand for what is right. And that is what Jesus is calling them to do here. Let me get a little water here. Okay, let's talk a little bit about Peter's confession. Jesus and his disciples went on the village around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, still others, one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Messiah." Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. Okay. You know, again, with this passage, you see something missing that Mark doesn't include, that Matthew did. You don't see the part about Peter having the keys to the kingdom. And again, I think for two reasons here, maybe like the situation when Jesus was walking on water. No, Mark wasn't there. He didn't have a firsthand account of these events. And maybe Mark received this information from Peter. So that is noticeably absent here. But he asked the question, "Who do people say I am?" And some say Elijah, and he talked about all these different people. But the real question was here was, "Who do you say I am?" Which we all know, like, confessing Christ is a personal decision. It's a personal commitment. And you see that in the scriptures, you know, where Jesus goes on and he talks about what true discipleship is. And so it was not just important for these men to personally confess that Jesus was Lord, but it was important from the standpoint of Jesus teaching his disciples and preparing them to carry on, Peter, James, John, all these men, and those who will follow him, to carry on his word and his ministry after that. He needed to know what their thinking was. And I can see Peter here saying, "You are the Messiah." And Jesus look at him and say, "Now, what does that mean?" And I'm thinking, "I don't know." You know, I mean, have you ever been like somebody asks you a question and you know the answer intellectually, but you don't really know all the ramifications of what that means? And that's where Peter is, I think, still. Now, Peter calls him the Messiah, which is rightfully so, that they were waiting on a Messiah, although many thought that Jesus was going to set up an earthly kingdom. But in their thinking, you know, Jesus is going to set up his kingdom. He's going to make everything right. But they didn't fully understand what that meant. Interestingly enough, and we'll read that in a minute, but verse 31, Jesus refers to himself as the Son of Man. Now, the Son of Man is a term in the Bible that you see a lot, and typically it just refers to man in general. But in this case, it refers to something differently. If you want to turn to Daniel 7, well, you can just listen up. I'm going to read what Daniel said about the Son of Man. Just a little portion here from verse 14. It says, "You will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven. He will be given authority, glory, and sovereign power over all people and nations, and men of every language will worship him." See, that's Jesus. It says that he appears when the Ancient of Days, as Daniel was telling about the different kingdom, the Ancient of Days, referring to God, would come, and then Jesus would appear, and he would be given all authority. And so that's a little bit bigger picture than what the disciples were thinking. Well, he's Messiah. He's going to come, and he's going to set up his kingdom here, and, you know. No, it's much bigger. So Jesus would come, and he would have all authority. And that's what we see here. So when he says Son of Man, he means something differently than what the disciples meant. Okay? Verse 30 says, Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. Okay? There's a reason for that as well. We did not read the example of the healing of the blind man just before this, but I think is a lesson from that I want to talk about a minute. In healing the blind man of Bethsaida, a few verses earlier, Jesus took him outside of the village to heal him. And you would think, okay, why didn't Jesus just kind of heal him there? But he took him away from the people outside the village, and his disciples were with him to heal a guy. And I think there's some definite reasons for that. One of the reasons was that there was all type of people following Jesus. There were people who were there to accuse him and to malign his teachings, you know. And you see that a lot. You know, ever tried to show someone something and you had somebody there who would say, "No, it's got to be done this way," or "You don't know what you're talking about," or anybody ever experienced anything like that? You know, but that's what Jesus is dealing with. You have these people, the religious leaders, who were trying to put him down at every turn, to catch him in his words and trying to malign him. And Jesus knew that. There were also people who were there to be entertained by the message. You know, John 6, Jesus said that to some of the people, that you were looking for me because you had your bellies filled. You know, they were just there like, "I want food, I want the miracle, I want the show." See, Jesus was not a sideshow, and Jesus did not give in to that. But I think the third reason why he took him outside the village to heal him is that Jesus had a lot more to teach his disciples. And so he was trying to get these guys to see and understand what it took to have faith and really what it took for Jesus to be who he was in dealing with all these things. He could heal this man and impact his life in a greater way without the sideshow that was going on. So you know, Jesus also, I think, realized that an uprising could occur, because, again, we mentioned last week that people were thinking, okay, here he is. He's going to take over everything. He's going to set up his kingdom. And people wanted to take Jesus by force and allow him to do that. And as we mentioned last week, that was not in his plan. Okay, disciples' confusion. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Get behind me, Satan," he said. "You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Then he called a crowd to him along with the disciples and said, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. Or whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in his Father's glory with his holy angels." Okay, one of the things that as a parent, after Peter's confession, and of course we hear Peter's confession, but I'm sure with the confession from the other disciples, I think now the disciples are ready for some higher teaching, some deeper teachings here. So Jesus begins to talk about suffering. And so if you can imagine these guys thinking, okay, Jesus is going to set up his kingdom here. Everything's going to be perfect. It's going to be rosy. You know, we're going to be his top dog, so to speak. But Jesus is not going in that direction. They're saying, okay, suffer and die. You know, we don't get this, you know. Again, put yourselves in their position. It's like that doesn't seem to go with the plan. If it's God's will to set up the kingdom, you just set up the kingdom. Why do he have to suffer and die? And again, Jesus, all along the last few chapters we've looked at, is challenging him, says, "You're still dull. You don't get it, you know." But I think as we go on and as the brothers finish the classes, you'll see that. But they're still kind of dull, and they don't get the big picture. But that's kind of how we are. It's like, you know, I was thinking about it as I was preparing this class, that there are things in my faith that I've struggled with for probably 8 or 10 years. And I said, man, I'm still dull. I don't get it. God said, "I'll take care of it. I've already taken care of it. I fed the 5,000. I fed the 4,000. But you don't get it. And see, that's how we can be. So they didn't understand that part about suffering. But true discipleship only comes through the cross. But again, you know, not to get off the point, but and I want us to think about this, because a lot of times we have things happen that we say, Jesus, this is not a part of the plan, like Peter said. You know, why did this person die early? You know, why do I have this sickness that's lasted for 10 years? And you can just fill in the blank. We go on and on. But it's really about God's will. And I was talking to someone last week after the class. It's like, when you can accept God's will, then you'll be happy and you'll be fulfilled. The battle is that we try to subjugate God's will for our will. And that's where we run into problems. So Jesus is trying to teach this lesson to his disciples. Now we're going to close by talking about the transfiguration. You know, transfiguration is really when someone's form changes, their appearance changes, and we see that with Jesus in this incident. It says that after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up to a high mountain where they were all alone. There he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. And there appeared before them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what to say. They were so frightened. Then a cloud appeared and covered them, and a voice came from the cloud. "This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him." Suddenly, when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man, there's that term again, had risen from the dead. They kept the matters to themselves, discussed what rising from the dead meant. Okay, it's like you get the picture that, okay, guys, don't you understand this? Well, they did not have the Bible. You've been reading the Bible for years, and we've had, this was happening in real time, and they didn't know how to take all this. It was really new for them. But, you know, as I was studying for this class, three questions came to mind. And I'm going to, as we close out, I want to pose these questions to you about this incident, the transfiguration. First question, why Moses and Elijah? Any thoughts? Jeff. Okay, great, great point. You know, and that was one of the things in my readings I came across. They talked about the departure. You know, Moses, in a sense, was taken straight to heaven. Moses also departed from Egypt with the people. Elijah went straight to heaven. Jesus would depart and then be raised again and come back. So great point. Any other thoughts? Mary. Okay, excellent. Let's look at that. As Mary said, she was reading my notes. I'm going to read some here. Luke 25, you can write this reference down, 25 to 27. It says, "Some of the companions went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see Jesus. He said to them, 'How foolish you are, how slow to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Messiah have to come and suffer these things and then enter his glory?' And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself." So Elijah, you know, represents the prophets. Moses brought the law. Jesus was a fulfillment of both. Why Peter, James, and John? Any thoughts? Anyone? Bueller? Anyone? Jeff, yeah. Okay. Okay, great. Any other thoughts? Okay. Great point. Peter, James, and John appeared with Jesus three times.
one at the healing of Jairus' daughter, those three exclusively, second here, and then at the garden at Gethsemane. So Jesus chose these three men in a special way to train and to prepare them to lead the ministry. But I got to thinking, well, why these guys? Well, Peter was the oldest. John was the youngest. James was the first to be martyred. I don't know if that has any significance. But I think probably the main reason for these guys, their willingness to learn and their humility to be taught after mistakes. I mean, we all know about Peter. You know, Peter was always quick to say something, to do something. But Peter represents, you know, that kid in class that, who knows the answer to this? Me, you know, he would raise his hand, and sometimes he would get it right, and sometimes he wouldn't. But, see, I was not a Peter in class, especially when I was in middle school. See, I was too concerned about getting the wrong answer and having my buddies laugh at me, you know. And there's some of you who are like that, and then there's some of you who's like, me, I know the answer. But, see, God can use people like that. You know, those who are eager, willing to be looked at, and he made mistakes and laughed at. But Peter was that guy. He was always reaching for more. You know, James and John was the sons of Zebedee. You know, these guys were kind of fiery too. But I think that was something that separated them. But, you know, ultimately, we don't know why these three men, you know, could have been just the Holy Spirit that says these three guys. But it's just something to ponder. And I present these questions for you to ponder because I was pondering these questions as I went through this lesson. Final question, why the transfiguration? Why this event? Any thoughts? Alan. Exactly. I think it was evidence for these guys to strengthen their faith and to prepare them for his death. But I think also, and you see it here in this verse, God wants us to know it's all about his son. So Jesus, this is a message, a theme you see throughout the Gospels and throughout the Bible and especially in the book of Hebrews, that is all about his son. God virtually says the same thing here, he said in Mark 1:11. You know, this is my son, listen to him. So you got Moses and Elijah, and these guys look like nothing compared to Jesus. And in our minds, that's the way it should look. Now, as I close out, one final thought that I had as I was studying this lesson. We always talk about when the kingdom comes. Well, some people think the kingdom came when Jesus came on this earth. Some think when he started preaching. Some think after he died and was resurrected, which is what the scripture teaches because he says there a little earlier, that some of you won't die until you see the kingdom comes in glory and in power. So technically, that's when the kingdom came. But think about it. The kingdom came early to these guys because they saw and experienced something that no one else did. But the thing is, they had to keep it secret, you know. Jesus said, you know, when I'm glorified, then you can let everybody know. Can you imagine having that kind of secret? It's like, man, I want to tell somebody, you know. You know, sometimes my wife will say, I know something you don't know. And she said, well, you want to hear about it? I said, no, just tell me later, just to kind of play around with it. But she's just itching to tell me what she knows. And that's how it is with a secret. But these guys had to keep this secret until the proper time. And boy, when it came, I'm sure they were shouting it from the rooftops that Jesus really was Lord. So that's the transfiguration, and that's the class for today. Brothers will continue looking at episodes and incidents in the life of Jesus' disciples Thank you for your time. Go get your kids. We'll begin our worship service in about 10 minutes.